Insight. I am Charlie from the past, and with me today is Allie from the past. How are you, Allie?
I imagine I will be doing just great come September. How are you?
I will probably be great. Hopefully, I will not be too pregnant anymore. This is a pre-recorded episode for my maternity leave. So when everyone hears this, I'll probably be sleep deprived with a baby. Now, if I'm sleep deprived because I'm overly pregnant, that's not going to be good. So it depends where my sleep deprivation comes from.
You'll be sleep deprived regardless.
I'm one of those people that lives in chronic sleep deprivation anyway. Tonight's episode is about the 1996 disappearance of Janet March and the winding road to justice for her. Many years after her disappearance, the state of Tennessee brought her husband to trial for her murder, even though her body was never found. But there are many steps from here to there, so let's start at the beginning with Janet and her husband Perry. Janet was born Janet Levine on February 20th, 1963, to Larry and Carolyn Levine. Larry was a successful lawyer, and by successful I mean wealthy. He built a law firm in Nashville, Tennessee. He was seen as a community leader, particularly within the Jewish community. Janet was into art from a young age. After she graduated from an elite private high school in 1981, she decided to study political science as well as art at the University of Michigan, which is where her parents had gone and also where they met. She too would meet her husband, Perry March, there. Perry's upbringing was quite different than Janet's. He was born in 1961 to Arthur and Zipporah March. Arthur had changed the family name from Markovic to the more American-sounding March. He claimed it wasn't to hide their ethnic heritage so much as he wanted a name that was just easier for people to say and to spell. Zipporah was from Israel and met Arthur when he was on a trip to Tel Aviv. Perry grew up in East Chicago in a fairly residential area. When he was just 9, Zipporah died. Arthur claims she had an allergic reaction to a pain medication, but the death certificate indicates it was an accidental barbiturate overdose, though the rumors at the time were that it wasn't quite so accidental. Arthur was a pharmacist, but it has been reported that he largely supported his family of 3 kids with his military pension. Perry did well in school, attending a local Catholic school after the family moved to Michigan, and he was active in sports and martial arts. He decided to attend the University of Michigan and major in Asian studies.
Janet and Perry met through a mutual friend while they were at the University of Michigan together. Their first date was reportedly meant to be at a Rosh Hashanah service, but that Janet had slept through. Whether this is what happened or part allegory, it does capture what May have said about Janet's personality. She was incredibly intelligent and talented, but had a stereotypical flightness of the artistic type. And Janet did fit this idea that she came and went as she pleased. She's also been described as difficult to please at times, but she had a large number of close friends who all saw it more as she knew what she wanted and she didn't waver. That same trait is what made her father a success and a pillar to the community. After Perry finished school, they moved to Chicago together for a job and opportunity he had there. Janet wanted to move back near her family, and Perry wanted to go to law school. It all worked out well when Janet's father offered to pay for Perry's law school at Vanderbilt in Nashville. In 1987, Perry and Janet were married. In a more non-traditional move, Janet was the one who got down on one knee and proposed to Perry. She wanted to take that next step, and Perry wasn't proposing, so she did. I think this is another glimpse into Janet's personality. She wasn't going to wait around for someone else. She was going to get out there and get what she wanted out of life. Now, I admire that and could probably use more of that in my own life. They settled into life in Nashville, with Perry eventually graduating and getting a position at a top-notch law firm. Janet continued her art career. She focused on illustrations for books. They had 2 children together, a son and a daughter, and they decided to build Janet's dream home on a 5-acre lot. Janet designed the home herself, and her parents helped finance it. Her parents didn't just finance this house. They had paid for Perry's law school and brought them their first house. They gave Janet the largest annual monetary gift they could without being taxed by the government. When Perry's father Arthur's property were being foreclosed, they bought it from the bank so he could stay in it. He lived for some time there rent-free. They then encouraged him to move to Nashville to be closer to the grandkids they shared, and he stayed in their home until he could get himself established. So while Perry and Janet both worked and certainly made a decent living themselves, they were also being subsidised by Janet's parents, who had the money to share with their kids. Beyond financial matters, Perry was also taken in by the Levines and treated like a son. Having grown up largely without a mother, and his father never remarried, he treated Carolyn as somewhat of a surrogate mother. It worked well except for when Perry and Janet were arguing, they would both go to her for comfort, advice, and venting. I can imagine Carolyn being in an awkward position here.
But before we go any further, we need to take a quick break for a word from one of our sponsors. You're going to spend a third of your life in your sheets. So are they taking care of you the way they should be? At brooklinen.com, you get high-quality sheets and bedding that you deserve at an accessible price. Brooklinen was founded in April 2014 by a husband and wife team. They have a very simple philosophy that we deserve simple, beautiful home essentials without the luxury price. Most high-end bedding is marked up by more than 300% by the time it reaches the store. Brooklinen cuts out unnecessary markups and manufacturing waste in order to offer exquisite designs and exceptional savings across their whole collection. This is luxury bedding, underpriced. You have to try these sheets today. I love my Brooklinen sheets, so try these sheets and I know that you'll love them too. Brooklinen.com has an exclusive offer just for our listeners. Get 20% off and free shipping when you use promo code SITE at brooklinen.com. In fact, Brooklinen is so confident that you'll love your new sheets, they offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all their sheets and comforters. There's no reason not to give these sheets a try. The only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use promo code SITE at brooklinen.com. That's brooklinen.com, promo code SITE. Brooklinen. These are the best sheets ever. And this arguing turned into full-blown marital problems, and it increased in the early 1990s. In 1991, when their older son was just a year old, Perry was fired from his job at the prestigious law firm he was working at. For all Janet and everyone else knew, there was just some office conflict, but the whole story was a bit more than that. In July of 1991, a paralegal in the office where Perry worked found a letter on her desk. She opened it, and it was a long letter, several pages, and it was unsigned. It alternated between poetic meanderings and flat-out erotic statements about sexual acts he would like to perform on her. The letter writer also confessed that he was a married man who had never been tempted to cheat on his wife before. This paralegal was uninterested in this ever so generous offer of sex with a married coworker, so she turned the letter over to her boss. The letter really was beyond what anyone could justify as appropriate, let alone appropriate in the workplace. The law firm hired an outside agency to help figure out who sent it and advise them on how to proceed. Within a month, two more letters appeared, and one of the letters told her how to get in touch with the letter writer if she was interested. It was some cloak and dagger stuff of leaving something in a particular book in the firm's library. So the firm hooked up some CCTV cameras in the library, and they found only one person go to check that particular book, Perry March. He was confronted and fired, though it's not clear if he truly fessed up to his behavior. He agreed to pay $25,000 in a settlement to the woman to keep all of this out of court. He was then hired by his father-in-law to work in his firm. Now, this $25,000 settlement will come up later. Part of the deal with Perry leaving the firm was that they would let him resign rather than be fired if he sought professional help. I haven't found anything that spelled out whether he was fired or resigned, But he and Janet did start marital counseling. And about a year later, Perry started seeing a psychiatrist on his own, though Janet would occasionally attend his sessions to work on their problems together. In early August of 1996, after a session the psychiatrist labeled as volatile, he suggested Perry and Janet have a trial separation. He also said that Janet angrily but vaguely mentioned what had happened at Perry's last job. Now, Perry had told his psychiatrist what he told everyone else, that he had to leave over a conflict with a coworker. And neither Perry nor Janet went into any greater detail about it. But in hindsight, this is a little inkling that Janet may have found out more about what happened than originally thought. So Perry ended up spending most of the nights leading up to August 15th, 1996, in hotels while he looked for a place to stay. Janet was staying in the dream house with the kids. To not disrupt things too much for the kids, Perry would keep his normal daytime schedule. He'd come home after work, they would have dinner as a family, and then he would help put the kids to bed around 7:30, and then he would leave for the hotel for the night. So the kids really weren't aware of quite what was going on.
This all gives us the backdrop for what is going on with Janet and Perry before she disappeared. So let's get to the night of her disappearance. The last people to see Janet March was October 15. Aside from her husband and children were two workers from the cabinet company. They were installing countertops as well as fixing a few other things. They said Janet hovered around them, supervising their work, and Perry was outside with the kids, and they left around 5 p.m. After this, we mostly just have Perry's version of events. He puts the kids to bed, as usual, around 7:30. When he comes downstairs, he and Janet start arguing about the same old things. Mostly all the things he doesn't do that he should do with the kids and the house and such. He offered to go to the hotel again that night. She said that instead she was leaving. She was going on a vacation for 12 days. She had already packed and had made him a typed list of things he needed to do while she was gone. A lot of these things were everyday things like balance the checkbook and do the laundry, things most grown adults don't need to be told to do. Not only did she make this list, she made him sign it. Then she said, "See ya," and she left. Perry called his siblings, and then around midnight, he called Janet's parents to tell them she had taken off and to see if they knew where she was going. Her mum, who thought this was very out of character for Janet, told Perry she was probably just upset and cooling off and she'd be back in no time. Because she wasn't the type to storm off like that, and she was especially not the type to leave without talking to her parents about it and making detailed arrangements for the kids. There are a few things that made the timing of this trip suspect from the start. For one, she had an appointment the next day with a divorce attorney and she'd asked her mother to go with her. Also, while the 12 days would have got her home in time for her son's actual birthday, she would miss the party she had planned and already sent invites out for, as well as miss his first day back at school. It didn't make sense that, no matter how mad she was at Perry, she would miss these two important events for her son. She'd also planned a play date for her son for the next day. Perry had since claimed he arranged the play date, but the mother of the other boy says that that did not happen. It was Janet she had talked to. And when she arrived with her son, Janet wasn't there. Perry didn't open the door. The little boy did. Perry called out from his office saying that it was fine to leave the boy there to play because their nanny was there to watch them. The mother honestly felt a little snubbed by the Marches, seeing as neither bothered to actually come out and say hello to her, but she figured her son would enjoy playing with his friend, so she left him there. One thing she did notice was a rolled-up rug that seemed out of place. When she returned to pick up her son a few hours later, that rug was gone.
Another person in the house that day was the Marches' cleaning lady. She said it was odd because some of the areas she usually cleaned when she came had already been cleaned and the trash had already been emptied. I know I have friends where we joke about how we clean before the cleaners come, but it was unusual for this family, and these were her normal areas that she cleaned, and she skipped them because they were already cleaned by someone else. Perry told her that Janet had gone to California, which would become the cover story told over the next several days. This was an attempt to avoid gossip about Janet just up and leaving her kids like that. So it's more or less agreed on by Perry and the Levines to use California as the cover. The cleaning lady said she did not see the rug, but Perry also told her not to clean the children's playroom that day, and that was near the area where the rug was reported to be. It could have been there, and she just wasn't in that part of that house. It's a 5,000 square foot home, so it's possible to have missed it, especially if she was told to stay away from that area. As we noted, their part-time nanny was there that day. She did not see the rug, and Perry denies it ever existed. She did say Janet acted oddly when she had been there a different day that week. The nanny only worked 2 days a week, so Janet usually took advantage of that time by working on her illustrations. On this day, however, she spent the whole day in the office, on the computer, and that's just something she had never done before. We're just going to pause right here to take a quick break for a word from a sponsor. We are very excited to have ModCloth come on as a sponsor. ModCloth believes that fashion is for every body, size, and shape. That's why their exclusive line of apparel is offered in a full-size range. ModCloth is the go-to source for unique women's fashions. They specialize in a broad range of styles. Quirky statement prints, vibrant colors, retro dresses, classic silhouettes, and cool contemporary clothing. Whatever the season, ModCloth's got you covered. Snag a new swimsuit for that summer getaway or a cute cardi for those first signs of fall. ModCloth's signature line of apparel comes in a full-size range, from extra extra small to 4X, so it's never been easier to find your perfect fit. Need a little outfit advice? Just reach out to their amazing team of mod stylists for free sizing, fit, and styling help. Go to modcloth.com, enter promo code SITE at checkout to get 30% off your order of $100 or more. Snag your next style obsession at ModCloth.
Within a day of Janet disappearing, Perry and the Levines decided to start searching. Even Perry had to admit that he didn't think she'd be gone longer than that night and that she didn't really pack enough to be gone more than the weekend at best. They did not call the police, however. Perry says the Levine says not to, but they say the opposite, that Perry was the one who didn't want to report it. But the reason is the same regardless of whose idea it was. Janet left voluntarily. Or she may have had some type of mental break from the stress of their failing marriage, the building of her dream home, and just the general stress of life with young children. After all, that's what the list was all about. It was a mum on strike sort of thing to show Perry all the work she does that he takes for granted. With their social standing in the community, did they really want her breakdown to become conversation for everyone? Instead, they conducted their own search. They called hospitals and hotels. They drove to the airport to look for her car in the parking lot, but they found nothing. No one matching her name or her photo checked in anywhere they tried, and her car was not at the airport. Meanwhile, Arthur March came back to Nashville from his new home in a resort town in Mexico. It'd been both reported that he came back because his son called him and told him Janet took off, and that he came back for his grandson's birthday. The birthday party came and went without Janet. The story became that, while visiting her brother in California, she developed an ear infection severe enough that she couldn't fly.
It wouldn't be until August 29th that Janet was reported missing to the police by Perry and the Levines. Along with reporting Janet missing, Perry reported that she had left with her car, and the police listed her car and license plate with the information. And it wouldn't take long for the car to be found. About a week after the investigation started, which is actually 3 weeks after Janet was last seen, her car was found in the parking lot of an apartment complex less than 5 miles from her home. The dirt, dust, pollen, that kind of stuff that collects on your car, that indicated that had been parked there for a while. In the car, they found Janet's purse, which included her passport, credit cards, and it was upside down in the pocket of the driver's side door. There was also a black suitcase with a few items of typical vacation type clothing, like sundresses and a bathing suit. What was missing in the suitcase, however, was odd. There was no hairbrush or toothpaste, and there were no bras. The no bra thing stands out to me because a woman going away for 2 weeks, she'd pack bras. The person who wouldn't think of it was a man who was not used to packing for a woman. I mean, obviously, this isn't proof that Janet didn't pack the bag, but it's pretty suspicious.
Yes.
A pair of her shoes were found on the floor of the car on the driver's side. Another odd thing was a car was backed into the parking space. Janet never backed into parking spaces. And I'll tell you, if my car is ever found backed into a parking space, you'll know I'm not the one who parked it, because like me, Janet wasn't good at backing up into spots, so she just never did it. So why would someone choose to park the car this way if it wasn't Janet? My only thought when I was reading that was that perhaps Tennessee is a state that only requires the rear of the car to have a license plate. By backing into the spot, the license plate would be obscured. So I looked online and then I fact-checked with some listeners in Tennessee, and that is the case. Tennessee only has rear plates. So someone who was casually walking by the car wouldn't notice the license plate if the car was backed in. Perhaps the person who left the car there thought this would just buy a little bit more time before the car was identified or called in. The following February, the police received a call from a flight attendant who lived in the apartment complex. He had just seen Perry March's picture on the news and recognized him from a previous incident from the previous summer. He was out of town frequently as he worked international flights, but on August 16th around 1 a.m., that same night that Janet had supposedly left the home for her trip, he had seen a man in the apartment parking lot with a bicycle. He said the man seemed in shock, and the parking lot was well lit, and they were standing fairly close to each other, so when he saw Perry's picture on the news, he recognized him and called the police. The implication here is that Perry had dumped the car and ridden his mountain bike back to the house. While Janet's car didn't have anything like bloodstains or signs of a struggle, it was pretty obvious to investigators that Janet either didn't leave the house of her own free will, or she did, but she met foul play at some point outside the home shortly after she had left. There was no activity on any bank accounts, and she left her items in the car where it had been left for weeks. A few days after finding Janet's car, Perry's Jeep was searched. It didn't appear to have been recently cleaned, though the detective said there was an odor of a cleaning product when he was searching it. Carpet fibers of various colors were found in the cargo area of the Jeep, and those were collected. I imagine that if that rug that was reported as being in the house was ever found, the hope would be that they could match them. And, you know, spoiler alert, the rug was never found. A DNA test showed that a hair from the cargo area did match Janet, but it's impossible to say that it was left there because her body was in there or she left it there another time while she was helping unload or load the Jeep. One of the difficult things in these cases where the victim and the suspect live together is that their prints and DNA will be in shared spaces. Perry's car also had brand new tires on it. They were bought on August 21st. Perry said it was simply something on the list Janet left him because his tires were bald, and he was working through the list. But the people at the tire shop found it odd because his tires were in good shape. They asked him why he was replacing perfectly fine tires. It was the company policy to tell the customer whether new tires were needed or not. And he said it was because he didn't like them and he wanted a different brand.
We should back up and talk a second about that note Janet made Perry sign about the task he would complete before she returned. Janet's brother Mark asked Perry if he could see the note on the computer. They were both at the Levine's house and Perry said sure, and for Mark to follow him to his house to get it. Perry took off in his car, even losing Mark by running a red light. When Mark got to the house, the door was locked and he rang the doorbell multiple times before Perry would answer it. Inside, Perry already had the computer on and the note was loaded up. Mark read the note and there were some things about the note that bothered the Levines. From the article, A Good Thing Gone Bad, the concerns were 1. Janet never typed notes. She generally would handwrite them. And if she didn't write them herself, she would dictate them to someone else, like the nanny, for them to write it down. But typing it out and printing the note, that would be highly unusual for her. 2. Janet made no mention of the play date scheduled for the following day or the birthday party for their son scheduled for 10 days later. Surely if she was going to list all the little things like do the children's laundry, then she would have listed to have their son ready for his play date. 3. Janet's writing style was to write all things in lowercase letters, including for names and at the beginning of sentences. That being said, some of that could have been due to the word processor automatically capitalizing the beginning of her sentences. I'm not sure if the word processor they used at the time had that feature. And finally, Janet dated things like lists at the top of the page. This list had the date at the bottom, which was more in Perry's style of writing things. But since she had him sign it, perhaps the date was at the bottom to be more like a contract, but I'm not sure. Mark did say the timestamp on the list on the computer was 8:17 on August 15, which is in line with what Perry said happened that night. He also saw another list on the computer that appeared to be the list of Janet's complaints about Perry. Perry told Mark he could print it, but Mark couldn't figure out how to get it to print from their computer, and Perry didn't show him, so he decided just to leave it.
The house and property was searched after Janet went missing with Perry's consent. They searched the computer with Perry present, but they did not do a forensic search on it. After it became clear to Perry that he was a suspect, his attorney advised the police that they could no longer search the house or the property without a search warrant. On September 17th, the police showed up to search with a warrant. They brought in cadets from the police academy to aid in the search of the acreage. There were also helicopters, cadaver dogs, and divers. Forensic experts came through looking for trace evidence in the house. Prior to this search, a detective had told Perry that they needed to take another look at the computer. So this time, they brought a computer expert to the house with them. But when they went to look at the computer, the hard drive of the computer was missing. Perry flat out denied having taken it. He said it was taken while he was out of town with the kids for the weekend. In an interview, he said he suspected that either his father or his father-in-law took it. Why would Janet's father take it? You know, maybe he thought there was personal information about Janet that he didn't want in the media. But that's a bit of a stretch. He was a guy who wanted to find his daughter. He didn't seem terribly concerned with the details at that point, and he wouldn't have done anything that blocked the path that would lead them to his daughter. As far as Perry's father, Arthur March, he said in an interview that he doesn't even know what the F a hard drive is. Arthur's story would later change, but we'll get into that later.
Perry was officially named a suspect in late September, and the next day he moved with the kids to Chicago. The Levines tried to stop him through the court, but he moved too quickly and without enough notice. They then decided to sue him for visitation with the kids. They had been a daily part of the kids' lives, a guardian ad litem, basically an attorney to represent the interests of the kids, that was appointed. When she visited the home in Chicago, she said she was alarmed that there were no photos of Janet in the home or any acknowledgement of her presence. She also said that their son remembers his parents fighting and his mother not being home in the morning. He also remembers there being a rug in the house that then disappeared. Noting the close relationship the kids had with the Levines, she recommended to the court that visitation be granted. But contentious custody battles don't just take months, they can take years. So we are at 1999 here. At a court proceeding that would have been a step forward finalising visitation, Perry didn't show. Only his attorney did. His attorney informed the court that Perry and the children had moved again, this time to Mexico, where Perry's father had retired to. The judge and the guardian ad litem had no idea this happened until that very day.
Honestly, we cannot even begin to get into the court proceedings that followed. There was more custody and visitation battles, including the Levines going to Mexico to enforce their visitation order. There were suits and countersuits for control of Janet's property and assets. Perry wanted her assets to help support their children, but the Levines believed he had murdered their daughter, so obviously they were deeply opposed to this. In 2000, Janet March was declared legally dead, though her remains had not been found. This opened the door for control of her estate and inheritance, but also a wrongful death suit against Perry. The Levines initially won the wrongful death suit, but it was overturned on appeal. Meanwhile, in Mexico, with Janet being legally declared dead, Perry remarried. His new wife had three children of her own, and then they had one together, which gave them six children altogether. Perry worked in finance in Mexico, and with that came some allegations from clients of fraud, and he and his wife eventually opened a cafe. He had both said Janet was a wonderful and devoted mother, but also that her disappearance was voluntary and that it had to do with drugs or possibly an affair. According to Perry, he told the kids that he didn't know where their mom was. She left the home, but they didn't know what happened after that. According to the Levines, he actually told the children that Janet ran away and had abandoned them. Then in 2004, Perry sent a photo to the Nashville DA that he had found in a magazine. A woman who looked like Janet was in a bar in Athens during the 2004 Olympic Games. He and his new wife believed that it proved that Janet had left and started a new life somewhere else. But no one else who saw that photo thought the woman was Janet.
There wasn't much to go on for years, and the police had only one suspect, Perry March. He was living in Mexico, building a life there for his wife and kids. There had been no accusations of domestic violence in the March marriage before, so what would have been Perry's motive? Two motives have been thrown around. While cleaning out the house after Janet's disappearance and Perry had moved to Chicago, a packet was found with Janet's name handwritten on the outside. Inside were the originals of the letters Perry had written to the paralegal. Apparently what he had given to the paralegal were actually copies of the letters. The last of Perry's payments to the paralegal were due, and he had sent her a letter in August saying he was having trouble coming up with the money. With Janet's comment to their therapist about why he left his job, is it possible she found these? He could have worried this secret of his would come out in court during the divorce or even just in society gossip. He was also at risk of being sued by the paralegal. The settlement is what kept her from taking this to court to begin with. Without Janet there, he could use the family funds or credit to make the final payment to the paralegal. However you cut it, his reputation was at risk with Janet alive. The second motive is just flat-out divorce. Let's just say Janet didn't know about the sexual harassment issue. He still could and should have been worried about the divorce. They held the note on the house they just built. They'd been careful to keep everything they gave Janet, in Janet's name alone, to protect her assets in the marriage. At the time, Perry worked for his father-in-law and was hoping to hang up his own shingle and take some of his clients from the Levine's law firm with him. Much of his respect in the community came from marrying into the Levine family, and all of that would be gone if Janet divorced him.
Just a little spoiler alert, I do think Perry did this, but personally, I don't lean towards this being premeditated in the sense that he was home that night and had planned on killing her, or that he planned on killing her any more than right before he did it. I think this was rage and panic of a narcissist. And I'm not the only one who thinks Perry did it. In 2001, someone doing business with Perry in Mexico reported that Perry threatened to do away with the man and his lawyer the same way he did away with his wife. In December of 2004, cold case detectives had built as much of a case against Perry as they could without Janet's body. They presented 59 witnesses to the grand jury and presented the case. The way grand juries work is that the suspect does not need to be present or even have knowledge of the grand jury convening. It's really about the state presenting the information to the jury to see not if there's enough to convict, but if there's enough to bring charges and go to trial. There's a saying here in the U.S., first made in 1985 by a judge, about the state's influence over a grand jury, and he said that grand juries can, by and large, indict a ham sandwich. So with only getting the state's case, it's not that hard to get an indictment sometimes. Knowing that Perry first fled Nashville after being named a suspect and then fled the country after it looked like he would have to allow the Levines visitation with the children, they didn't want him to catch wind of the grand jury and take off somewhere else. Obviously, none of the 59 witnesses were relatives of Perry or anyone who else who would tip him off because he didn't know. The indictment came through and Perry was then charged with the murder of Janet. The only problem is he was in Mexico, but that wasn't a huge problem because Mexico didn't exactly want him. And in August of 2005, after working with the FBI, Mexican authorities found some cause to deport him. When Perry went to the cafe he and his wife owned, immigration officials arrived, told him his visa was revoked, and he was being deported immediately. They picked him up at 8 a.m., and by 9 a.m., he was on a plane back to the U.S. Now, this is quite different than the process in many countries, where a person is first detained, then given access to legal counsel and possibly options to remain in the country. Mexican deportation is very swift, apparently. Perry did not have time to stop it from happening. When he landed in L.A., he was arrested and immediately flown back to Nashville.
On the way from L.A. to Nashville, Perry made conversation with the detectives accompanying him. Knowing Perry was an attorney who certainly knew his rights, the detectives told him flat out that they had no intention of asking him any questions on the trip from L.A. to Nashville. Perry made a comment about wanting to make a plea deal and that he wanted to settle this. While the detectives didn't tell him to shut up and stop talking, they also didn't ask him any questions. Honestly, I'm sure they were hoping he'd just keep talking, and that he did. He laid out some terms he would like in his plea deal. The detective told him that he wasn't in any position to make promises, but he would pass the information on to the district attorney. He also asked, according to one of the detectives, about the degree of murder for an accidental homicide. In Nashville, Perry appeared in court and he was charged with second-degree murder and was given a $3 million bond under the impression he was a flight risk. He couldn't pay it, so he was held in jail until his trial. One lawyer put it that Perry's entire job while waiting for his trial was to sit in jail and keep his mouth shut, but that's not what happened.
Talking turned out to be a real problem with Perry all around. Next to him in a cell was a man named Nate Ferris. In talking to Nate, Perry said he wanted a hitman to take out Janet's parents. He believed that without their testimony, there was no case against him. And before everyone goes, we can't believe jailhouse informants, this gets better. Nate told his mom about this, and his mom in turn told the Levines and also told Nate to report it. So Nate sent a note to the district attorney. Of course, they wanted proof that Perry March was saying all this, so Nate wore a wire. Nate was able to get Perry to repeat his desire to have the Levines killed, as well as an offer that Nate could find refuge with his father Arthur in Mexico. And that brings Arthur into it. Nate was moved to a different jail, but Perry was told he bonded out. So Perry thinks this is it. Nate's going to get out there and he's going to kill the Levines. And Nate keeps in contact with Perry on the phone, but he also starts calling Arthur. And Arthur is all in. Within the first 10 minutes of their first conversation, he started giving Nate advice on the gun to use and how to avoid leaving prints. The children at this point were living with the Levines, so Perry had a concern that Nate had to make sure he killed them when the children weren't in the house for the children's safety. Nate eventually called Arthur and said the job is done and he'll be in Guadalajara at 2:30. Arthur showed up to the airport to pick him up, and he was met by FBI agents, because remember, Nate's actually still in jail this whole time. They questioned him about why he was there, and he said he was there to pick up a friend. To not tip their hand too much, they told him that the friend was being detained for immigration issues, and Arthur left the airport. He soon filed something called a recurso de amparo, which is basically a legal protection of his rights that prohibited Mexico from deporting him. He probably was seeing the writing on the wall here. But like with his son, Mexico was not interested in keeping him protected there. So as soon as his amparo expired, the authorities showed up to deport him. Having promised he wouldn't leave Mexico without a fight, he did pull out a knife, but no one was hurt. And also like his son, the authorities drove him right to the airport, put him on a plane home, where he was promptly arrested on conspiracy to commit murder charges.
Police and prosecutors believed Arthur knew what had happened to Janet, and possibly when he came to Nashville a few days after she disappeared, that he was involved in the cover-up. They played the tapes of his confessions with Nate Farris, and that, if convicted, as he most surely would be, he would be sentenced to 7 to 10 years just on the charge of conspiracy. That didn't count on in any charges they brought against him being accessory after the fact to Janet's murder. At this time, Arthur was 78 years old and not in good health, so a 7 to 10 year sentence, look, that might as well be a life sentence for him. In weighing his options, Arthur picked the option that seemed a little odd. He had been ready to be part of a murder plot to protect his son. He would, as we're about to find out, help conceal the murder of his daughter-in-law to protect his son. But he wasn't willing to give up his freedom for his son. He agreed to plead guilty to the charge in relation to the plot to murder the Levines and promised to cooperate in the case against Perry in exchange for only 18 months in jail. Arthur, to put it plainly, rolled over on Perry. In a tape disposition that was later used in trial, Arthur said that Perry confessed that he and Janet got to a fight and he had accidentally killed Janet by striking her with a wrench. Perry had hid Janet's body on a nearby property, but the property was going to be developed soon. Because of his connections with real estate law, he found this out and knew he needed to move Janet. Perry dropped Arthur off at the edge of the property, and using Perry's directions, he was able to find Janet's remains, which were in a large bag. He then carried the bag back to the spot near the road to wait on Perry, and they put her in the truck. They then drove about an hour or so north together until they stopped at a motel near Bowling Green, Kentucky. Perry said he was so tired that he stayed at the motel while his father took Janet's remains to a concealed location with a brush pile. Figuring a pile like that may be burnt eventually, he used it as a spot to hide the remains. They then travelled back to Nashville. In returning to Bowling Green, Arthur could not positively identify the spot and Janet's remains were not found. He also confessed to being the one who took the computer's hard drive at Perry's request. There was no physical evidence to corroborate his story, but they believed him. He was consistent with his answers during questioning.
I'm just curious how you would accidentally kill someone by hitting them with a wrench. I think having a wrench in your hand and hitting them is pretty purposeful. But in June of 2006, about 10 years after Janet disappeared, Perry's trial began. Their children were teenagers at this point, and like I said, they were living with the Levines. One of the things that interested me most about this case was that it was a no-body homicide trial. These are pretty uncommon, and you can understand why. If you cannot prove someone is dead, there's automatic reasonable doubt of the accused. Prosecutors may be reluctant to take the case to trial because of double jeopardy. In the U.S., double jeopardy is near absolute. We talked about this and how it differs in Australia and the UK in our episode on the Eastbourne family murders. But if Perry was acquitted and they found Janet's body a year or two later with evidence all over, they couldn't retry him. No body cases are becoming more common because of advances in forensic science. We can prove more that someone is likely dead through analysis of blood stains and that sort of thing, which of course doesn't apply directly here. I do recommend the podcast Court Junkie if you are interested in how no body cases are tried. The episode is a short one and it's called No Body Murder Cases. The attorney she interviews, Tad DiBiase, runs a blog and has a book on the topic as well. And you can find him at nobodycases.com. Without the body or much forensic evidence, the state's case was largely circumstantial. In addition to what we've already talked about, there was another jailhouse informant who testified that Perry confessed to him. Arthur March was too ill to testify, so his taped deposition was played.
The defense case was first to approach the major issue, that there was no body to prove Janet hadn't just walked away. Secondly, they cross-examined the prosecution witnesses hard in an attempt to chip away at their credibility, or at least the accuracy of their memories from 10 years previous. And lastly, they had a taped interview with Janet's oldest child for a few years after his mother went missing, where he said she came into his room to say goodbye that night and he had seen her drive away. This directly contradicted other evidence. First, Janet's mother said you couldn't see from the son's room what he claimed to see. Also, his kindergarten teacher testified that during the first week of school, he told her he was sad because his mum left and he didn't even get to say goodbye to her. Also, the guardian ad litem in Chicago during the custody battle said that the little boy said he heard his parents arguing, he fell asleep, and when he woke up, his mother had left and he never saw her again. This story that came out years later, that his mum said goodbye to him, it doesn't sound reliable since he was consistent immediately after she left and within a year or two of her leaving, they did not say goodbye to her that night.
Of course, the implication here is that Perry March coached his son, which is just adds layers to how terrible this case is. 10 years and 2 days after Janet March had last been seen, the jury found her husband guilty of second-degree murder. He was sentenced to 56 years. He has since exhausted the last of his appeals when the Supreme Court denied his final petition in 2015. Arthur March was sentenced in the murder plot against the Levines on the same day Perry was convicted. Although prosecutors agreed to take the 18-month plea sentence, the judge refused it and sentenced him to 5 years. It wouldn't make much of a difference in the end because just 4 months into his sentence, the already very ill Arthur March died. Janet's kids first left Mexico to live with Perry's brother, but then the Levines got full custody and raised them. They are both adults now.
Perry March maintains his innocence. He works in the prison law library helping other inmates with their legal issues. In a 2014 interview, he said he occasionally hears from his daughter, but not from his older son. He didn't mention his wife in Mexico. His three stepkids or his kid there, and I haven't found any information on them. Janet's brother Mark and his father worked to change the laws in Tennessee, making it harder for those suspected in the deaths of their spouses to retain parental rights of their kids. Mark also worked on legislation to protect victims of domestic violence.
Though it is believed that Janet's remains were left, as Arthur confessed, near Bowling Green, Kentucky, they still have never been found. I just cannot imagine what would have happened in this case had Perry not tried to hire someone to kill the Levines. The case, frankly, wasn't terribly strong until he roped his father into this conspiracy plot and his father decided to confess everything to get out of a lengthy jail sentence. Perry might actually be free today had he just sat in his jail cell and kept his mouth shut and waited for his trial. Thank you guys so much for listening this week. We don't have shout outs because, again, this is a pre-recorded episode, but want to thank everybody for listening and supporting us. You can find us on Facebook, just Insight, two words. We have a page and a group. Twitter at Insightful Pod. That's generally me monitoring it, though I imagine when this comes out, I won't be doing such a great job. We're also on Instagram. You can talk to Allie there at Insight Pod. We have a website, insightpod.com. Email us at insightfulpod@gmail.com. On our website, we have a PayPal link if you want to make a one-time donation, but we also have our Patreon where you get bonus episodes and merch and other thank yous. So if you want to go check that out, even with maternity leave, we are also pre-recording Patreon bonus episodes. So there will not be a break in those. And we will see you guys back next week.